I don't know much about the pornography, but I looked at a tiny little bit and went,
oh, okay, really?
Yeah.
For purely research purposes. Listeners, this is the 8th of February, episode 27, no, episode 26 of season 2 of
Already
Bad Voltage.
Already got it wrong.
And as you can hear right there, we have John O'Bacon back for this episode. Once again, thanks to Wally for joining us for episode 25, now that I have it correct. But good to have you back, pal.
It is good to be back, but you know, I couldn't think of a finer individual to gently nestle his feet into my shoes. So that sounded creepy coming out of my mouth.
That was way creepier than you intended, I think, to be honest with you. Nonetheless, welcome back. What have we got on this show?
So I was going to say, in addition to an absolute load of news, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, I built a computer quite recently. I built a PC, and it's the first time I've built a PC in 15 years. So I'm going to share some of my observations and then receive an inordinate amount of mocking from these two Muppets that I tend to do this show with.
That does happen. I'll be honest with you. Yes, that does happen.
Yes.
I want to talk about deep fakes. This is a way of faking video with other people's faces on it. And what it means and why the hell it has to just be used for porn and nothing else, as far as I can tell.
And, on a completely unrelated note, why Ack needs a load more RAM in his computer.
Shut up.
And on that bombshell, and now, Bad Voltage.
Shall we do some news?
This news.
I think we should. It's always times for news. I love doing the news. Okay. Can I start?
Yeah.
Because there is one story that really captured my imagination in the last couple of weeks. Rapper 50 Cent. This is a gentleman with a distinguished musical career, but really fell on some pretty rough times. Like, he was bankrupt and he had apparently like significant debts, but was still spending $110,000 a day or something ridiculous, because that's the life of a rapper. It's definitely not the life of someone in the heavy metal world, let me tell you that.
Or indeed, I don't want to disillusion anybody, but JavaScript people also not doing this. community consultants, perhaps. Me, not so much.
No. Anyway, apparently a while back he released an album called Animal Ambition, and he allowed people to buy the album with Bitcoin. And then it turned out that, you know, he was having these bankruptcy issues. He completely forgot about this Bitcoin element and left his account unused for a certain period of time. And then he discovered that he had a shitload of Bitcoin and is now a millionaire to the tune of about $8 million because he forgot he had Bitcoin.
It's unbelievable. The thing about 50 Cent that fascinates me, as a hip-hop fan, I'll say I'm not really a 50 Cent fan, which is neither here nor there. But he has made more money doing random things than I think he's made with music. Do you remember when he bought a small stake in Vitamin Water that ended up being worth $100 million?
I know.
He's not really 50 Cent the rapper. He's the 50 Cent the accidental investor who happens to make music.
I know. I mean, fuck that guy, right? I mean, good luck to him for doing this. But fuck a guy called 38P who accidentally discovers he has $8.5 million in Bitcoin.
I kind of want a English parody rapper that's named 38P now.
I'm so cross about the fact that he just did this. I mean, God. It's so
good
annoying.
To see that the Stuart Langridge vitriol lasts well into 2018.
Yeah, I read somewhere today that apparently people who win the lottery, there's like a fairly significant chance that you're going to die when you win the lottery. Like,
it's crazy. Yeah, it's bonkers. Very consistent over countries and years and everything.
Hang on. Like a heart attack from the shock, or because you just You go, so, hooray, I can now spend $6 million on the world's biggest pie and then die of a heart attack.
It turns out if you don't have a ton of money and then don't gradually make money but are suddenly given just an epic amount of money, you do stupid things with it.
Right.
And it causes a lot of strife. So there's a lot of weird accidents, quote-unquote accidents. But there's just a lot of drug overdoses and misery. Yeah, if you look at it's an interesting stat I saw it a couple years ago.
It wouldn't surprise me if 50 Cent wins the lottery and then lives a long and happy life and spends his money responsibly on, you know, investment funds and slippers.
And not a solid gold helicopter or whatever the hell else he's bought with it.
Anyway, I wanted to get started on that because that has rocked my world for the last couple of weeks. All right, what's next?
I was so cross about that. I should also point out, also in Jono's list of things, Jono's list of news, is a thing called Axe FX 3, right?
Let's talk about it. Yeah, let's do it.
I haven't even bothered to Google this stupid, presumably guitar item that I don't care about. But go on, how is this news to anyone who isn't you, Baconio?
Well, it is news to me, I'll be honest with you. It might not necessarily be news to other people. So the Axe FX is it's actually quite cool. It's a box that basically models analog guitar amps, right? So like for years and years and years, I find this interesting from a tech perspective. So obviously for years and years and years, you know, you've used to seeing the big Marshall stacks behind the stage, that kind of famous Jimi Hendrix sound. That is the sound of a tube amp, right? And tubes don't, you know, it's not like in the digital world, if you strike a note in a digital amp, you get the same note each time, right? You get the same sound because it's digitally reproduced, but tubes don't behave like that. They're vacuum tubes. So you get variations based upon effectively the physics and the chemistry that's happening in the tube and how that mixes with the rest of the amp and stuff like that. So years ago, this guy called Cliff started this company called Fractal Audio, and he created something called the Axe FX, and it was an attempt at making modeling amps. And lots of other companies have done this, whatever, whatever, whatever. The difference is with this guy is that when you go out and buy usually a piece of musical equipment, you buy it and it might get a firmware upgrade, and that's about it, right? And then it's you have to go and buy the new piece of hardware. When Cliff brought out the Axe FX, there was a constant stream of these firmware updates, and you can actually go and see the release notes of like what happened. And it's difficult to kind of gather what's going on because it's so technical, but it's interesting seeing, like with the Axe FX 2, over the course of it's been out for I think 4 or 5 years, there's been 20 firmware updates where like the software is consistently getting better and better and better, but the hardware's staying the same. So anyway, the Axe FX 3 was announced last week, and for me it's obviously exciting because I'm a guitarist and I've got a little studio at home and all the rest of it, but this thing's like 4 times as powerful as the Axe FX 2. And I think what's going to be interesting about this is that iteration of software development where they're going to be modeling each different element of an analog signal chain is going to be getting more and more comprehensive, more and more powerful. I just think it's kind of interesting that in blind A-B tests between an analog tube amp and the Axe FX, people cannot tell the difference. Audiophiles can't tell the difference.
I have a question about this.
Oh boy.
As you know, I have an assertion about this. I put it to you, Jonathan Bacon, that were I to show up in, say, the year 2000 and say, your manual tube amps, right? I'll just write a piece of software to do it. You would have given me a bunch of lines about how it's impossible to recreate the warmth of a true guitar note in software. And you'd have said, I know nothing about music, and would have punched me in the face.
Well, you might have a point.
Right, this is my thing. If I'd just gone, now it's just a question of just tweaking how we generate the WAV file, you'd have gone, shut up, you computer nerd, you know nothing about guitars. And this is literally what this thing is. I mean, I think it's great. Well played to the bloke.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is that, like, as far as I'm aware, with the way again, from an engineering perspective, the way the Axe FX works is they've modeled each of the individual components. So they're not just trying to make a replicated digital sound of actual device sounds like. So
they're
simulating, so to the point
the
where
tubes,
that yeah, where they when they add an amp to the Axe FX, this is like 200 odd amps in there that use this model, you know, use this modeling in different ways. they actually need the schematics of the original amps to be able to put the correct components in there, to the point whereby if you turn one of the dials, so for example, on a Boogie rectifier, if you turn the gain up, the master volume will, if you turn the master volume up really loud, the gain switch has different, it reacts differently depending on the master volume switch, right? You could never do that digitally, but when you model the individual components, you can do that. And to me, it's just, it's fascinating modeling the analog world in digital, in any of its forms.
So this is like an all-in-one preamp version of your guitar pedal, the Mod Duo or whatever it was. You reviewed like a couple years ago.
Yeah, the Mod Duo was basically...
That's just a pedal, obviously. This is a preamp, but...
Yeah, I'd not heard of the Axe-FX when I saw the Mod Duo, and that was what excited me about the Mod Duo. The sad thing is the Mod Duo, I mean, I think that the guys there are doing a good... You know, they're doing a lot of work, but it's nothing compared to Fractal Audio, so... But anyway... you see, Ack, it was interesting.
That's actually more interesting than I thought it was going to be, I have to say.
Yeah, you shithead.
I'll give you that.
To be fair, I only wrote Axe-FX 3 winky face into the news notes, so you have every right to be suspicious. So.
Yes. So, since we're talking about entertaining things, have you seen the Nintendo Labo?
No. Is this that cardboard thing?
It is the cardboard thing.
I haven't really seen much about this.
It seems intriguing to me. What their idea is they basically will sell you cardboard peripherals, right? So there's a whole bunch of different things to go with games on the Nintendo Switch. So they've got a kind of a cardboard fishing rod. Right, and cardboard pianos and stuff like this. And you get these things as a flat sheet and then with all the instructions sort of fold it up and so on, right? Which is, because I've always been fascinated by how Nintendo peripherals for the Wii and things like that, there have been all sorts of guns and stuff like that, but they're purely mechanical. They're kind of an empty plastic shell, but when you're firing the gun, all it is just got a little plastic thing which pushes the button on the Wiimote. The peripheral you buy is not in itself clever. It's not. It's just a plastic shell. And this is essentially that, but extended to cardboard, right? The reason I think this is interesting is not particularly because they've done a thing with cardboard, but that it might, potentially at least, create a new sort of community of people building their own things, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
love it.
It's not very clear exactly how you'll be able to write games which work with this and how you'll be able to model these things and so on and so forth. There'll be software on the Switch, but that doesn't seem like the optimal kind of editing environment for things. So I don't know. And Nintendo are not particularly open as regards community stuff, historically. Maybe they need some consultation, Jonathan. Give them a ring or something.
But I agree, Stuart.
But I think it's potentially an interesting kind of a thing to happen. I'd be interested to know if anyone out there who's got a Switch is thinking of getting into this.
The thing, I know we've said this previously on the show, but the thing that I really admire about Nintendo is that they're always trying something new, you know.
And
a cynic could suggest that they're just peddling gimmicks, but, you know, there is a fine line between a gimmick and innovation.
Yes.
and I think that it's really neat that they do this
stuff. Should I tell you what that fine line is? If it works and everyone buys it, it was innovative. If no one buys it, it was a gimmick.
That's true. Right.
call me old Mr. Cynical, but this is a winner's right the history.
Steve Wally's back in the show. So, by the way, I have to say, good work on that show. It was really interesting. Steve Wally is always entertaining, so
he is.
Good work, fellas.
So speaking of always trying new things, have you seen that Elementary in the next version will not auto update apps that you haven't paid for? So basically what they're doing is, starting with the Juno release, they're going to, if there's a paid app that you haven't paid for. So for those of you who don't know about the App Center, any of the paid apps, you can put zero in and not pay for. But you can obviously also pay for them. And to release some numbers on that, they released it in May of 2017, and they've since processed $1,700 in total from 750 charges.
So how much?
$1,700.
Since when? Sorry?
May of 2017. Nice. May of 2017. 750 charges. A little less than 1% of people seem to be paying. So in the next version of the OS, if you click update all and you put in zero, it won't actually update the app. you can go up there, you can go and individually update them for zero, or you can choose to pay at that time and they'll auto-update. And they said for security updates or quote-unquote critical updates, which I don't know the definition of that for them, they will always auto-update regardless if you paid or not. So what do you think about this new attempt at a business model here?
I think, I mean, what they're, I think, trying to get around is they're pretty firm about the idea that they want people to pay for apps, but they don't want to require you to pay for apps. Mm-hmm. So they've got this pay what you want model for all the apps in App Center. Yeah, someone can put in an app as free, and that's fine. Or they can put it in as pay what you want, and then people can pay what they want, including zero. So, and I think given that model, this is an interesting little thing. They're not preventing you from getting updates. You just got to go and do it manually.
So, in a little bit of context, too, they asked people why they weren't paying for those that weren't. And a lot of people said, well, they didn't know the value of an app up front, so they put in zero. And then even if they did find value in the app later, they just forgot about it. So this is kind of a gentle reminder, as opposed to doing some kind of pop-up or context interrupting thing. This is a non-context interrupt way to remind you that you haven't paid.
And I think that this interestingly dovetails with things like reviews, because at the point at which I'm presented with an app screen, whether that's on the desktop or on my phone or whatever, the screen about that app in the Play Store or the iTunes Store or App Center or whatever, the point at which I'm given the opportunity to review it is the point at which I know least about it. The moment before I install it. And who the hell sits there and goes, I haven't got anything to do. I think I'll review some apps. You have to be really dutiful for that. Which means the only time anyone ever wants to review an app is if they were really annoyed by it. So all your reviews skew negative. Yep. And this is the same this is the same problem, right? You want to nudge people at a point when they're happy with this app to say, maybe you should have paid $2 for this.
This is one of those things, I think, where there is a an intellectual view of this, and then there is a practical, pragmatic view. And I think from the intellectual view, I think it's really neat what they're doing, right? I appreciate how they're trying to build financial sustainability into the project while also really respecting the freedoms of their users. And that's really neat, I think. And I think this is an inventive way of doing things. And as we've said before, like, it's always cool when you see like new and inventive ways in which people can try and blend open source community and you know, the financial piece. From a pragmatic perspective, I just, like, I don't see it accomplishing anything. This is going to sound a bit mean, but it's not meant to. If they're making less than $2,000 since May in 2017, it's not working. It's just not working. Like, $2,000 is nothing.
No, you see, I
$2,000 across an entire operating system for app developers is the equivalent, I would agree, to nothing. I think their end goal is to have developers for the platform that make a living. And I think this is one of their attempts to get there. Whether it will or will not is definitely up for debate. But they'd have to go from $2,000 to $2 million at least.
And I would argue, just finishing off that point, that if they're making that little money, then why add any ambiguity? Why don't I just have everything completely free? Like, if you're making such a statistically insignificant amount of money that you can utilize it for anything of any particular relevance or value, then why even have this ambiguity? Just make everything available for free that everybody can use.
I think that's why they're iterating on the idea.
So,
is why I think they're trying to create a culture in which paying for things is not seen as weird and aberrant. I think a large portion of this is down to the fact they haven't got that many users. You know, if they had 25 million users or 250 million users, this would be a perfectly sustainable, brilliant business model, at which point it would stop being a gimmick and start being innovative. I think condemning it at this point is the wrong thing to do. Yeah. Because we want people to experiment with new stuff, right? Because none of the other business models that anyone's ever come up with work either for open source stuff on the desktop.
Yeah, no, I get that. But the point I'm making is that, like, we don't know how many users they've got. And I agree with you. They've probably got a minimal user base. Let's assume they have 100 users, right? If they've got 100 users and they've raised...
I think even whoever hates Elementary the most in all the world...
No, I know, they haven't got 100
users. More than 100 users.
But imagine, for the sake of argument, they've got 100 users and they made $2,000. That's not too bad, right? But if to your point, like if they've got, you know, how many users do you think they? If you just hazard a guess,
they're very clear about roughly 1% of people pay.
Yeah.
So they've released that number.
Okay, so 1% of people. Oh, that's good to know. So 1% of people pay. That, but what I'd like to know is how much do they pay?
I was like two, like that was in the post.
Yeah, and they have talked about some figures before now paying for elementary itself. So you talk about a couple of dollars, right? So if
$2, hang on, 1% of users spent $2.30.
So the exact sentence from them is, let's talk numbers for a second. We released App Center in May of 2017, and since then we've processed about $1,700 worth of payments from a little over 750 charges. On the one hand, this is good because it means the average price paid for an app in App Center is about $2.30. We have to remember that this is a non-zero number in an ecosystem where previously the standard was zero. So there is progress happening here, and progress is good. And then he goes through a couple specific examples.
That is fine so spin, right?
1% of downloaders pay for Harvey and Nimbus, and the total payout for those two apps in aggregate is $200 over the last 8 months. It sounds like he...
So if they're saying 1%, if they're saying they had 750 charges and 1% of people are paying, then we could extrapolate that they've got...
75,000 app downloads from App Center. You don't know how many apps an individual person has.
Yes.
But it's on that order. Yeah. So if you assume that everyone only downloads one app, that's 75,000 users.
So it sounds like the person who made the most, just as a data point, is David Hewitt, who made $330. 0.75% of downloaders paid for Clipped and Torrential.
And to be quite honest with you, right? What did he say there? $330.
So he's at a run rate of about $500 a year.
Right. Okay. That's on a par, very roughly, with the amount of money I made from Riddling, and that was in the New York Times. Writing apps is not a lucrative business.
You made $500 from Riddling in aggregate on iOS and Android after it was in the Times?
No. You said per year. Right.
Yeah. So, okay. For the next year.
And I said very roughly it was probably about double that, but the point is it wasn't 10 times that.
I'm actually very surprised about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, so were we.
I mean, yeah. And I to be clear, like I'm skeptical that this is going to work, but I in no way suggesting that they shouldn't try, and we should encourage them to try. And if you're an elementary user, you should go and pay and support the project. I just think that people paying because, like, people paying because they want to support the project will only get you so far. People need to pay because they feel like they're getting some kind of specific value, which is hard in the open source world.
That's totally the thing. I think they've been pretty clear about the fact they don't want people to pay out of some sense of duty and devotion and donation to the project. They want people to pay because they're getting software which they think is worth the money.
Yeah, I guarantee you that every single one of those payments was paid out of duty and devotion of the project. I don't believe any single person at all who spent money in elementary wasn't doing it because they didn't want to support the project. Guarantee you it.
I'd be interested to see how you reconcile any way of making money with open source software.
So I have a philosophical question here, getting a little off topic, but directly related. If success on the Linux desktop ends up meaning that we have to move to a paid app ecosystem with, I would imagine, a mix of closed and open source apps. Would you prefer that we have that success or we stay where we are now? It's a difficult question and an interesting one, I think.
This is a question Langridge and I have discussed in many an Ubuntu-funded hotel room while working at Canonical. Because I think it's a really important question. Like, I think in our view at the time, because a lot of the Ubuntu App Store strategy has been mixing, you know, paid and free apps. Our view, and I think my view still stands, is that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, there's a difference in my mind between the core community and the infrastructure of the platform and the shit that you run on the platform.
Frankly, I want really good apps. And I don't know a way of getting really good apps while the people who make them don't make any money from it, because all you can do then is just do it in your spare time.
Yep.
You know, there are other ways of funding things, but I don't think there are for Linux desktop apps.
So I'm curious.
There's got to be some money in the voltage community.
What you think of this? Because I think there's definitely a split between people who think anything that's paid, certainly anything that's closed source and paid, they just don't want on the platform. And then I think there's some more, I'll call that the dogmatic view. I think there's some more pragmatic view that I want better apps, and part of that is paying for those apps.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I agree.
I would still like them all to be open source. You know, if they're not, then I can live with it. But I'd still rather they're open source. Just the point is that I'm okay with paying.
The critical thing in my mind is that you have to be able to support both the dogmatic and the pragmatic preference. So yep. I would always want to make sure that a Linux desktop allows people to run a completely free software platform, you know, to a reasonable extent. I mean, yes, you've got questions around firmware and stuff like that, and you can take it to the ultimate RMS level, but broadly, you can run a free platform. It might be a little bit more work to run a completely free platform, but to me, that's okay. But then if you want to get, you know, Call of Duty and Skype and Slack and whatever else, then that should be fine as well. So very interesting. Shall we move on?
Yes, we shall.
Hang on, what else? Let me load up the document. Should I do a bit of news?
Well, no, we've got tons of news.
We do. I was going to say, we're already at almost 25 minutes and have not made it halfway through the news. So
we're halfway through the show. We've done halfway through the news. So
can I talk about some news? I've got my final bit of news, and then I'll get mine out the way.
You're allowed to talk about this one because I'm going to look smug while you're doing it. Carry on.
Another argument for us being a video show. So Intel have announced that they have built some smart glasses, which are somewhat reminiscent of the Google Glass. I saw a video on I think it was The Verge. They did like a little piece about it, and they look quite interesting. Now, from the piece that I read, it says the most important parts of Intel's new Vaunt smart glasses are the pieces that were left out. There is no camera to creep people out. There's no button to push, no gesture to swipe, no glowing LCD screen, no weird arm floating in front of the lens, no speaker, and no microphone for now. From the outside, the Vaunt glasses look like eyeglasses. When you're wearing them, you see a stream of information that looks of what looks like a screen, but it's actually being projected onto your retina directly. Now, yeah. I'm curious to see what you guys think about this. We have been, if I'm being frank, a bit derogatory towards Google Glass in the past. So go on then, smugness man. What do you think?
this seems a pretty big step towards one of my predictions for the year, in my opinion. The one where it said a major firm will put out a set of augmented reality glasses.
Oh, that one.
doesn't seem applicable.
This is not that, to be clear, but it's a reasonably big step towards it. What I think is interesting about this is they've recognised something we discussed in that prediction show, that glasses are a fashion item.
Yeah. So interestingly, I thought this would happen. I thought it would be someone like Warby Parker. I didn't think it would be a tech company.
No, agreed.
It kind of makes sense that it's Intel, though. If you think about like their fabrication capabilities, it's blindingly obvious that it could be a company like Intel, because apparently everything is custom in these glasses.
Well, yeah,
like,
you want to get as much technology as you can into an ordinary set of glasses frames, which are not that big, being able to draw things which are 16 nanometers across helps with that.
And I have to say, for those of you listening to this who haven't seen these, they look like glasses.
Actually looks very close to the glasses you have on right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't look like, you know, a pair of glasses with a vaporizer attached to the left,
thing. I haven't quite grasped exactly what they're for, because they're not a thing that you control. They're not an input device at all, as far as I can tell. They're just a monitor. But yeah. I don't get how you are to control what is displayed on the screen. I mean, maybe you've got things like the Google Solar thing where you're making weird gestures with your hands. But if I've got to look through my glasses my phone screen to decide.
I'm guessing it's a smartphone app, but I haven't researched it.
Well, yeah, but if you've got a smartphone app, then you're looking through the glasses to the smartphone app, at which point I'm looking at the damn screen anyway.
Right. I mean the initial.
I bet you anything this is all about presence, right? So if you're if you are stood on a high street, it will show you.
So you're seeing it being like a nearby. Be like a smartwatch or whatever with pop-up notifications.
Yeah. And in which case, what I think is really interesting about this is, and in the bit that I read out, which is the reason why I cut and pasted that, was it is about what they've left out. Like Google Glasses was all about sci-fi kind of invention. And this is more about, you know, I just think it's interesting what they've done here. And they look very impressive. One question I have for both of you is, so when I first heard about bone conduction, where, you know, you hear something because it's conducted through your bone, I thought, I don't want no bone conduction happening ever.
Why?
And now when I read this,
how do you think you hear things?
Well, I mean, from a device. I mean, yes, I appreciate that that's how ears work.
I wasn't even going to get
it. It's not injected into your brain by magic power. It vibrates bones in your ear. Right? You're not picking this up from the sub-ether or something.
But yeah, the idea of this, you know, a device, you know, vibrate my bones, it just seems a bit weird. Not that device, anyway. But the beaming something directly onto the retina...
Again, this is how vision works.
Yeah, but it's a laser that's beamed from a device.
From a fairly close distance.
From a very close distance. Like...
It's a television screen. This is how televisions work, right? They light up, they emit light, which hits your retina. This is how trees work as well.
A television doesn't beam a laser.
Well, that's
onto
how CRTs work. That is not how newer
well, whatever.
It turns out CRTs really damaged your eyes, and LCD screens and OLEDs and all those are much better because they're passive devices that don't beam things directly into your retina. So I'm a little suspicious of something less than an inch away from my retina beaming things directly into it. But I haven't looked at the technology, opinion here.
The whole thing about you know, when you were very young and your parents used to tell you not to sit too close to the TV because it would ruin your eyes, this is like that turned up to 11 as far as I can tell.
Yeah, so you can see where the closest Jamba Juice is. I mean,
no. I don't know. I mean, I think... If I could have my existing glasses retrofitted with this, I'd do it tomorrow.
Really?
I think it's a brilliant idea. Yeah.
Interesting.
I liked the idea of Google Glass. The two things I didn't like about it was, first of all, everyone could see you were wearing it, and secondly, because they could see you were wearing it, they called you a glass hole in the street. Right?
Man, I went to Ohio Linux Fest one time, and I was in a bar, and there was a guy in the bar with Google Glasses on. It's the first time I'd seen them in person. And this poor dude, he's a really nice guy, but this guy got just fucking eviscerated by everyone in that bar. Like,
the robotic
no
arm was a little
alone.
Unsettling. It just, it was something about it.
It's just the notion that you don't know if that person's recording your conversation and you're in a bar. It's like, I don't want no conversation when I'm hanging out socially being recorded.
I think that's the thing. Part of what people didn't like was the fact that it was an input device. Whereas this is just a monitor.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so that's potentially okay. And I think, I mean, did you actually try Google Glass? Ignore all the issues around it. Just the experience of having it there. And so you could essentially look into a monitor that was there.
I did, yeah. For me, it was weird because I thought it was trying to think
what conference it was. You tried it on the same time I did. They were the same persons, and I genuinely don't remember who it was. But the first thing that struck me, because Jono tried him on right before I did, is as he was scrolling through things, it looked like he was having a seizure, and it was a little disconcerting. So just the whole way the UI worked, it really looked like he was going to go down.
That's just my resting seizure face. All right. What's next?
I have one more thing.
Okay.
Which is a terribly serious and worthy thing, but it's something that seemed interesting. The EU are currently in the process of proposing a thing called the Digital Single Market Directive, which is a bunch of generally useful stuff about data collection and privacy and that sort of thing. But Article 13 of that says the following, right? Information society service providers that store and provide to the public access to large amounts of works or other subject matter uploaded by their users shall, in cooperation with rights holders, take measures to ensure the functioning of agreements concluded with rights holders for the use of their works. Basically, what this is if you are YouTube, you have to implement Content ID, right? If you're busy serving up loads of stuff, you've got to put some measures in place to make sure that people can't just upload stolen films or whatever. Not, in theory, a terribly bad idea, but the problem is, as usual with these kind of things, it's incredibly loosely worded. It's basically anyone who hosts files. So, not just YouTube, but as it's currently written, GitHub, GitLab, Dropbox, Pastebin, anyone who's hosting files now needs to implement some sort of Content ID thing to make sure that people aren't uploading stuff to it. So imagine GitHub, for example. They're going to have to put something in place to make sure people are not uploading films to GitHub. And YouTube,
so you're YouTube
spend millions of dollars implementing Content ID. So the concern here is that someone smaller now has to do this, but won't be able to in any sane way.
So the interesting thing with me is it's really good, I think, to see the EU taking a little bit different views than some other organizations and entities across the world with regards to data privacy and things like that. The thing that concerns me about this and about GDPR, which has been a nightmare, is things are so broadly worded that legitimately no one knows if you are afoul of that thing, and that's dangerous. Because if you don't know, especially because the repercussions, especially in the case of GDRP, are pretty severe. So if you have a severe repercussion and a very broad interpretation, it makes things really difficult on the implementation side.
Can you explain what GDRP is?
GDPR. It's basically...
BBPR, okay.
It stands for General Data Protection Regulation, right? And it's essentially... And you said, you remember the Data Protection Directive, general rule about data privacy and what data you're allowed to store about people, how you're allowed to do it and so on. This is that 2.0, essentially. Okay. It's about, they're trying to put together a set of harmonious data privacy laws all across Europe. So everyone implements this. So you've got things like in the UK, you've got the ICO, the Information Commissioner's Office, and they're in charge of saying what data people are allowed to collect and what you have to do with that data to ensure it's that it's securely looked after and what you're allowed to keep and what you're allowed to not, and what you're allowed to sell on and what you're allowed to not, so on and so forth. And this is basically attempting to pull those regulations together. And GDPR is, at base, a good thing. Right, it's a pretty strong set of data privacy rules. I'm obviously in favour of this sort of thing, and as Jeremy says, it's nice to see the EU taking a stance on this. They have in the past and still today, generally, I think, been prepared to say we're gonna take a strong stance on this kind of misuse of personal data by people. That's, you know, we're not having that, so on and so forth. But they do have a habit of writing laws in such a way that they apply to way more people than they're necessarily thinking that they will.
Yes.
You write a law which is essentially the YouTube must implement Content ID law, but it applies to basically anyone who hosts files for any reason. And obviously rights holders tend to be massively in favour of hugely maximalist interpretations of this sort of thing because they don't want you to upload films to Pastebin. And if the law doesn't include Pastebin, then people will use Pastebin to upload films, right?
It's weird here because
equally, there's a pretty heavy, oppressive thing on smaller organisations who don't have the resources to Content ID things. Especially since, how do you Content ID stuff? You go to the filmmakers and say, please, can we have a database of fingerprints of all of your films so we can do it? And they go, certainly, that'll be $2.5 million a year or whatever.
Well, the other thing as well is I know from working with a few different companies that have platforms that an increasing problem, particularly in the US, is just the volume of DMCA takedown notices, like requests from organizations where, you know, if you've got some content and there's an impression that is violating, you know, somebody's rights. Whether it is or it isn't, you know, that in itself, people have like entire teams devoted to that. So on one hand, in my mind, it's not just about like being able to resource the implementation of software that can do that, but it's also, I suspect that the amount of those requests is going to increase as well. So, and that's going to tie teams up. So, but then again, like, you've got to have reasonable copyright protections in place as well.
No, absolutely.
But I mean, like, it's just the definition of what reasonable is. So,
yeah, I'm not saying that the core idea is bad. There will be people out there who are saying that it's bad and so on.
But it's a bit general.
What I don't like is that it's drawn so widely that it's going to be really unfortunate. It's going to pull into its ambit, its orbit, a whole bunch of firms who you really shouldn't think it should apply to.
Yeah. Damn. Archive.org.
Well, imagine, think about Archive.org. Where are they going to get $100 million to build content ID from?
Well, plus, like, the data erasure clause, how are they going to know they have data, given what they do, for them to be able to erase every bit of data about you is problematic, let's go with.
Yeah. So I want to bring it up because I thought it was interesting, and it's a not very good article in the context of an otherwise generally reasonably good law.
Yes. Well, thanks for getting everyone down on that Langridge.
Sorry, have you got a bit of a downer.
We're having so much fun about 50 Cent and the Axe FX 3.
Undeserving rappers earning $8.5 million for doing nothing.
We need someone to build a device that can model the life of 50 Cent so other people can experience it too.
Don't we just go and buy 50 Cent Blood on the Stand on the PlayStation 2 and just play it over and over and over again? Is it a PS3 game? Do you ever play that?
Play what?
50 Cent Blood on the Sand. I didn't make it up. It was a real game.
No, of course I didn't.
It wasn't very good.
I tell you what I did, though. I built this computer and played Battlefield 1. It's the first PC game that I've ever played. So it's the first game I played with, like, a... And this is not a particularly hardcore graphics card, but Jesus! It's incredible what PC graphics look like these days. It's changed a lot since EGA.
Exactly, yeah, you know. You get 17 colours now.
More on that later. So, recently, I did something which I haven't done for a very, very long time. So, don't make any jokes. I can see you both gearing up to it, okay?
Was it going to say a word?
Particularly you, Langridge.
I know not what you mean.
So,
I built a PC.
Oh, no, it wasn't a sit-up.
What were we saying about a shining emerald city of glass houses, Mr. Langridge? Okay, so... moving house and setting up a little recording studio in my new office, and my PC, my laptop, is not really cutting it in terms of audio production because I run a lot of plugins, and which are pretty CPU intensive. So I started looking into building a PC, and I thought this was interesting for a few different reasons. First of all, I haven't built a computer, a PC, probably for 15 years. So it was interesting for me that the same method is, it's basically the same, right? You take a motherboard, you stick it into a case, you put a power supply in there, you plug things into the motherboard, right? And then you switch it on and it doesn't turn on. So you push the RAM in even more and then it turns on. Okay. That hasn't changed from what I can tell in 15 years.
Hang on. I admit technology moves on fast and things are a lot different and so on, but you were thinking maybe you didn't need a power supply, now it's 2018, were you?
No. I was expecting all of that to remain the same. What's interesting to me is it's a little bit... did you ever see Flight of the Navigator, the movie?
Yes. Not sure where you're going with this.
So, you know, in Flight of the Navigator, right, the kid kind of... gets taken away by an alien and comes back like 15 years later, and everyone's grown up and everything's different, but it's all familiar. There's this one scene where he goes back to his house and he starts crying because he's at his house, but, you know, there's no one there and it's all different. His parents are all grown up. His brother's grown up. I had that Flight of the Navigator moment when all this shit arrived from Newegg. And I was like, the RAM now looks like a ninja weapon. Okay, when I started out, it looked like a circuit board. Yes. Now it's got like sharp points and some of it's got LEDs that are on the top. You know, like the CPU fan is like It's enormous, right? It's the size of a computer.
CPU fans, you know, every now and again you see these things where they've got a really big fan and then you can float above it with a parachute and it's like you're flying. That's what CPU fans are like now.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it. So I'll run through the specs because I know some of you will be interested in that just so we've got a baseline. But then I was just curious for us to have a conversation. Well, just curious. Well, not so much curious, but more interested in having a conversation about the current state of computers. So I bought an 8th generation Intel i7. It's a 8700K because it can be overclocked because apparently overclocking now is something you can use. You can use a fucking mouse in the BIOS now. Did you know that?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Flight of the Navigator. You can use a mouse and click a button, and it will do the overclocking.
This is like bringing Henry Ford forward in time and showing him a Lamborghini Aventador.
So I got 8700K. I got 32 gigabytes of DDR4 RAM, which runs at 3200. Two 500 gigabyte SSDs. That was in itself an adventure because I was trying to figure out how to shove the how to fit the SSD into the hard drive bay, and then I didn't realize that you actually just put them on the back of the case. They've got little slots that you screw on. It's like, wow, they've thought of everything. Cable management, that's something I'd never noticed or done before. What else? I got a gigabyte Radeon 560, which is not a particularly powerful graphics card, but I needed low DPC latency on this, and a lot of the GeForce graphics cards have got high DPC latency for audio real-time stuff. So I'm not really going to be doing any gaming here, but I was just saying in between recording, I said it in the last segment. When I played Battlefield 1 with that card, I was expecting it to be a bit crap and not as good as a PS4, that kind of thing, because it's a cheaper graphics card. This thing looks amazing. It looks like real life. It just stunning. So it just astonishes me also how quiet this machine is. I got this Be Quiet Dark Power 850 power supply, and I got this Nocturne NH15 CPU cooler. And my major worry with it being in my studio is that it doesn't make loads of noise. It's silent. I've never noticed a PC be silent before, right? I've never experienced that because I haven't built or used a PC really like this in 15 years. So it's just astonishing. I mean, am I alone in this in this view? Like, it's new, but it's different. And also one final point: whoever thought that putting LED lights in a motherboard was a good idea, that person needs to be locked up, okay? It's like sticking neon lights underneath a car when you're 16. It's lame. And I just wanted a motherboard where you didn't have that switched on. I tried to buy a case that didn't have a window in the side, and that was difficult. I feel alien right now.
I will say, I only built my own PCs for the vast majority of my computing life, and for the first time, my last computer I just bought. Maybe I'll go back.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here using a desktop machine right now, as I have mentioned before, right? As far as I can tell, there are two and only two benefits to buying a laptop. The first one is you can take it places. Fine. I grant you this is an advantage.
Which is the entire point of a laptop, by the way.
The second point is that all the stuff comes with it. So you don't have to separately go and buy a webcam and speakers and things like that. But yes, and I grant you that if you'd actually need to go places, like the two of you, your main machine should probably be a laptop because, you know, you go a lot of places and go to conferences and work from different meeting rooms and all this sort of thing. But at least half the people I know have got a laptop and just never move it off the desk that it's on. And as far as I can tell, this is some kind of huge scam that's been pulled by computer manufacturing companies who've convinced us to buy less good computers for more money. Which you have to replace every few years, right? All right, shut up, InfoWars. But yeah, I think having desktop machines is a good idea. I mean, to give you a stupid example, I need more RAM in this, so I'm thinking about just upgrading various parts of it. Might buy a new motherboard for it.
You know, well, the average computing user is not going to replace a motherboard, certainly.
No. But then what I think is interesting is, Jono, you built your own machine. I didn't. I'm like, wow, life is way too short to work out which kind of RAM goes with which kind of slot.
I'll be honest with you. It was, I did I did my research. I did a lot of research, and part of it was learning, like, about all this stuff. Like, again, the last time I built a machine, I didn't have to think about different types of memory.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, so, like, you just went right for RAM bus.
I just, you know, it was like me looking up, like, what is an M.2 slot? I had no idea what that was.
Yeah.
You know,
I didn't want to know any of this stuff because I've been living my life a long time. I know how it works. So I'll find something which looks okay. And then when it arrives, it won't plug in and I won't know why. So I used to have a firm called PC Specialist. But I went to them and said, these are the things that I want in it. But if these, you know, we pick the best motherboard that goes with it. I think this cooling system seems okay. But if there's a better one, choose that for me, right? I don't want to have to know about this. Life is too short. But that seems like a middle ground in between going and buying a completely pre-built machine and learning all this rubbish and then building your own. Did you do the thing with the static wrist strap where you have to touch radiators and stuff?
No. But I tell you what, I must have touched the metal case of the machine every 3 seconds. You know, it was like, I was like a 15-year-old learning to boil an egg where you're constantly washing your hands. Like, it's just, it was ridiculous. Do you know what the most terrifying moment was for me? Was when it said in the research that I did that you have to squirt some thermal paste onto the CPU.
Yeah.
That was something I never used to have to do.
And if you put the heatsink on top of the CPU and fix it down too hard, it breaks your CPU in half, and then you've got to buy another one. All this kind of thing.
Have you done that?
I'm not doing this.
Got to be pretty unlucky to do that, though, I think.
Yeah, but this is me, right? I'll exactly do this. If it's possible to do it, I'll find a way of doing it. I'm not doing this. But yeah, I mean, my machine is, because I built mine, well, I had mine built for me, haha, in 2014, so it's now 4 years old. But it's an i5 rather than an i7 like yours is, and it's got 16 gigs of RAM rather than 32. I thought about 32 at the time and thought, what do you need that much RAM for?
Mind you,
and
it turns 16, out the answer is 16 slack. Gigs. Well, hang on, 16 gigs 4 years ago was a lot of RAM.
It was,
right?
It was a lot of RAM, yes. And mine only had 180 gig SSD because it was 4 years ago and it cost as much as a house. It's now got a 1 terabyte spinning RAS drive, which is fine. All right. Rich boy with his two SSDs. I couldn't afford that.
Well, and the thing I didn't know as well when I started building this, because I had no idea how much this stuff should have cost. So my machine ended up coming in all at about $1,800.
That's right. Yeah, mine was about 1,500 quid. So it was a bit more. But then I got a 27-inch, 29-inch monitor in that.
Well, and the people who are buying our house, this guy works in technology, and he's really into gaming, and he was telling me that, you know, it's crazy how expensive graphics cards have got because of all the crypto miners. So he said, you know, if you'd have built that machine like 6 or 8 months ago, it would have been way cheaper. But I had no idea. I just looked at the prices on Newegg. Okay. And I trust Newegg. So
yeah.
Anyway.
But no, I mean, I think, if you travel a lot and use a laptop, but often you don't move away from your desk. I'm starting to think maybe the thing to do is get a decent desktop machine, which can be upgraded, is cheaper, and then maybe have like a Chromebook for traveling with, or some cheap laptop that you don't.
Well, I think it depends on people's individual needs. Like, I mean, I travel a reasonable amount.
Yeah, not for you. Yeah, you'd be working on it one day in two somewhere that isn't your desk.
Right. But I think, you know, even for people who don't necessarily go to conferences and stuff like that, I think a lot of people like the freedom of going and sitting in a coffee shop or, you know, sitting upstairs or laying in bed with your computer or working down or going downstairs onto the couch or sitting outside if it's a nice day. I think the portability piece is, in my mind, is essential. Like the idea of, I mean, while I spend a lot of time in my office, the idea of being having to be in here to work would drive me mad.
I think it depends
on the individual, because you pretty consistently work in your office, right?
Yes.
And you're completely fine with it. So I think it just depends on the individual.
Yeah, I may be unusualist, but I certainly think if you've got the option to have a desktop machine, they're good in all sorts of ways, you know?
Yeah.
You get much freer choice of the stuff you want in it. If you want, yes, if you buy a laptop, you can put more RAM in it if you want to. You can put a bigger hard drive in it if you want to, so on and so forth. I have to say, I'm slightly surprised. I assume since this was an audio production machine, the way you would build it is by giving your credit card number to Apple.com.
No. Now, I'll be honest with you. I don't like, I'm not a particularly big fan of switching over to a Windows-based setup. Like, my studio machine is...
Wait, this is a Windows machine?
Roy Shesterwitz would have kittens if he saw this machine.
I honestly didn't know this, but I would have been bollocking you through the entire segment. I didn't know this.
Yeah.
I thought you were going back to Linux. I mean,
no, it's an audio production machine. He's been abundantly clear in the past that the Linux audio production tools aren't up to scratch.
Yeah.
For him.
This is running, maybe this is running Windows 10.
Hit a point that was usable enough for his use. I don't know.
Wow. It's running Windows 10. It's running Cubase 9.5, Superior Drummer 3, a bunch of Waves plugins. This thing is like NSA levels of proprietary.
A serious point here. Friend of mine, Mike, my designer, I might have mentioned him before, right? He's a Mac guy through and through, Apple guy through and through. And he was saying, he's a bass player and he's been jamming on bass stuff. And he said, I want to do drums, but GarageBand is rubbish at drums. And I said, have you tried Hydrogen? I think he exists for the Mac. And he went and tried it, and then came back to me about half an hour later going, this is the best thing ever. Now, it's possible he thinks it's the best thing ever because the last time he used a drum machine was about 1996 or something. But if you haven't looked at it for a few years, it might be worth glancing at Hydrogen just because apparently it's good. I don't have an opinion on this because this is an audio thing.
Yeah, without turning this into a drum segment, the reason why I'm a big fan of this tool called Superior Drummer, because what it does is they've recorded original drums and everything about it is configurable. So to the point whereby you can control like the bleed in each of the different mics that are placed in the room, which actually makes a big difference. Like if you listen to most rock music, when you hit a snare drum, you hear the room, but with your cymbals, you don't hear the room as much and stuff like that.
So your complaint about a piece of open source software is that it's not configurable enough. The worm has turned here.
There is a first time for everything.
Indeed. What is quite cool about Superior Drummer as well, which I thought was interesting, is that you can play into it some music of like a WAV file of a drum kit, and it will use, get ready, machine learning.
Shut up.
It will use machine learning to basically detect not only when the hits are, which is easy, but it'll detect what type of drum it is, and then it will generate like the MIDI note. You can convert that analog audio into MIDI data,
drums.
and it will detect the drum type. Which for a snare drum and a hi-hat is interesting. But think about tom-toms. Like if you've got five tom-toms,
wow,
it's fucking incredible.
That sounds really clever, actually. Oh, okay, I'll give you that one. Second music thing I've been interested in. So. Why did you build it yourself rather than have someone build it for you?
Or just buy an HP or a Dell or a System 76 or whatever.
Yeah, or just buy a machine. I mean, I'm assuming you didn't just buy a pre-built machine because you wanted to specify the detail of the stuff in it.
I mean, honestly, it was, to be honest with you, the main reason, I actually wanted to learn how to do it and do it again. I like the idea of kind of refreshing my knowledge, and I wanted to make sure that I got like a very specific, like I optimized this completely around audio production. So I knew what kind of CPU I wanted, what type of RAM that I need. You know, I wanted to make sure that everything was perfect.
That's fair.
And it was fun, you know.
Which, the most important question is, which case did you buy? Did you buy some crappy beige case so you can hide it under the desk?
This case is badass.
No, it's important.
It's called a Be Quiet Silent Bass 800, and it's got soundproofing on the inside of the case. So,
it's got orange lines on it and a window.
Well, I got the black one. I couldn't find one without a bloody window. I don't want to see these stupid neon lights. So,
mine's got smoked glass sides and brushed aluminium.
I have to say, your case is quite nice.
It is.
I did mock you on it originally.
It's fabulous. Mine's the Imwin 904, and it's brilliant.
But yeah, I realized, though, that, you know, this whole, like, soundproof case is kind of pointless because even when the machine's going full whack, it just doesn't make any noise. You're like, the fan is bloody enormous. I mean, it is ridiculous. I put a picture up on, you know, on the internets and yeah, but it's very cool. I'd encourage anyone who hasn't built a desktop computer to have a crack at doing it. If you can afford it, if you've got the time for it, it's a good learning experience. And yeah, like you said, I mean, I can switch out the hard disk if I want to, I can add more RAM if I want to, like, not that I think I'm going to need to. When I had Cubase going full whack, it was only using about 6 gigabytes.
See, I thought this when I got 16 gigs. I flirted with 32 at the time I built the machine, but I thought, you know what, it's just too expensive. And everyone I spoke to said, what are you going to do, run 70 VMs? What do you need that much RAM for? And now I find my machine swapping from time to time, so need more RAM. It's all Slack, I tell you.
Yeah. Slack is a brutal behemoth.
The Beta 3 is a lot better if you haven't tried it, but
I don't understand why it's so heavy. It's a chat client. Let us be clear on
this. Well, it's an Electron chat client, I guess.
Do we think the fault is with Electron?
I would.
Or other Electron apps? People talk about Atom being pretty slow.
Oh, for God's sake. Right, you know how we were not going to talk for too long on this? Dropping the "is it Electron's fault" thing a nanosecond before the end of the segment is not the way to make that happen.
It's a
fair assessment. Point. Yeah,
yeah, but is it? Is the question? I'm just kidding. All right. I'm trying to pick up the subtext here that you want to stop talking about this, Ak. Is that right?
Have you guys seen this deep?
I had not seen it until you suggested it for this segment.
Is this something to do with the X-Files?
It is not. So, this is a slightly unfortunate subject to talk about. Someone came up with the idea. You've heard before about the idea of mapping one face onto another in a video, right? People have been doing it in sci-fi films and on things like NCIS for years.
Right?
The idea that you could say, okay, here is a piece of video of one person, but you map someone else's face onto it so it looks like it's the someone else in the video.
Yeah. Okay.
You know? So, a bloke put together a piece of software, runs on Windows machines only, and it needs a high-end NVIDIA card. But basically what you can do is you feed it a bunch of still photos of one person and a bunch of still photos of a second person, and then it can replace the first person in a video of the first person with the face of the second person. Right, so you let this thing run for quite a long time, you know, 3, 4, 5 days or whatever. And then you can say, okay, here is a video of the first person, and I can just seamlessly replace it pretty realistically with the second person, so you can't really tell it's been altered. Unfortunately, getting into the discussion of this means that you have to talk about the fact that it's been used basically for nothing but pornography, which I was rather disturbed to discover that there's a Reddit.
Has your face been superimposed?
I'll be honest with you.
To Ron Jeremy or something.
I heard about this thing, and there's a subreddit for it, and you go look at this, and the top post is a stickied post saying this is how to get the thing installed and where to get it from. Everything else is the most appalling pornography you've ever seen. Oh, my God. And I have not.
Hang on. When you say that, I'm assuming you're saying that, you know, people are taking, I don't know, Natalie Portman, her face, and putting it on like a porn video. Is that the kind of stuff you're talking about?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And this is.
Haven't people been doing that for a while anyway?
Yeah. But the point is, instead of it being some kind of really clever, skillful piece of work, you can now just basically point. So anyone can do it.
So, I mean, it's obviously been possible for a very long time for big budget studios to make very convincing fakes. The thing with a big budget studio is they're not going to do that because they have to worry about being sued for libel or a whole variety of things or ruining their brand or ruining their reputation, where now it's being commoditized in a way where individuals who don't have those kinds of worries can use it. So this presents some interesting topics, I think. One of them is, so are we going to go back to a world where professional reputation matters again, because it's very difficult to ascertain whether something is legitimate or not. Or are we going to go to some kind of, you know, cryptographically signed cameras where every frame is signed with, you know, the camera source and where it was taken and when it was taken, so that even changing one frame breaks that authentication? I think it's interesting to see where this would go.
And I think the whole worry about taking this technology, which previously you could do if you were Industrial Light and Magic, and making it available to anyone with an NVIDIA card, is that, yeah, before, maybe if you're Beyonce and someone made a video of you which wasn't actually you, you could sue or whatever, and you knew one of the 12 firms in the world with the capability of doing it and so on. But now, if I watch a video of Jeremy on YouTube giving a talk, I don't know that it's Jeremy anymore. Where ILM are probably not going to bother faking a video of Jeremy doing a talk, right?
Right.
But now, you know, I mean, Jono, people have for a joke in the past imitated you at things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it would be relatively easy with this now to take a talk being done by someone else and put your face on it in a way that someone viewing the video wouldn't necessarily be able to tell.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is nothing new, is it? Because people have been able to digitally misrepresent people in other ways for years.
So pictures, yes, but video is kind of new.
And to be honest with you, if you sent if someone said, here's a picture of Jono throwing children into jet turbines.
I'd like to know where you get the original source video for that. That's more of the problem.
Well, I'm fine, yeah, but you see my point. You just go, well, it's a fake picture, and everyone would go, yeah, okay, pictures are faked. You know, we've seen Photoshop. But people don't tend to think of video, I wonder if it's Photoshop. They might think, I wonder if it's been altered. But if someone showed me a video of you, I wouldn't immediately, well, I would do if it was the jet turbine thing, but I wouldn't immediately think it's probably fake. Now, that feels like a step change in the way that people don't rely on photos of things for evidence of stuff anymore.
Well, hang on a second. Isn't this where the uncanny valley tends to protect us? Like, if I go and look at some of this horrible pornography, am I not going to notice immediately that it's not Natalie Portman? I mean, I don't know why I'm picking her as an example. It's not Natalie Portman's face. It's a horrible vectorized version of her face.
This is the thing. And I don't know much about the pornography, but I looked at a tiny little bit and went,
oh, really?
Yeah.
For purely research purposes.
Yes, actually.
Didn't go out for 2 days.
Exactly for this. And it does.
Research the show more than any show in the history of Bad Voltage.
Too much of a problem.
That's why he needs more RAM in his computer, by the way, because he wants to run deep.
Yes, thank you. Right. I mean, I suppose I brought this on myself by just bringing this whole topic up.
yes, you did.
But it seems plausibly realistic to me. And there are people who have done demonstration videos of this which are not grotesque pornography as well. So it's certainly something where if you imagine a video of you doing a talk, a Linux user group or something like that, and someone's filming it, you know, from the back of the room or whatever.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, you could do it there in a way that people wouldn't be able to tell, certainly not just by looking at it.
But what's the alternative? I mean, I think we all agree that, as we've had many conversations in this show and as we did beforehand with Lugger Radio Act, I mean, there's always going to be cases where technology is going to, you know, provide negative social implications of this kind of stuff. Like, I remember years ago, people were talking about, you know, there was that famous case where the guy who played George McFly in Back to the Future
Crispin Glover. 2,
yeah, he sued the studio because his likeness was used in Back to the Future 3, if I remember right. Oh, no, in Back to the Future 2, I think it was. And he won, right? And it resulted in new rules that relate to the use of likeness and stuff like that. I think we all agree that this could be a problem, but, like, what's the solution?
Well, I mean, obviously you can't put the genie back.
I don't think there is a solution, really, is there?
It's going to be an escalating arms race, as it always is, between being able to fake and being able to detect fakes. But I think the implications are, think of all the things where video is used. Evidence is a good example, as Stuart mentioned earlier. If you can no longer trust video for things like alibi or things like proof that you were somewhere, weren't somewhere, did something, didn't do something. If you can no longer trust video, that creates a lot of weird situations that you're adding ambiguity where it didn't exist before.
And yes, this has been, it was possible before. So if you see video of Donald Trump doing something implausible, then yes, he has a bunch of well-funded adversaries who might have been able to employ someone like ILM to fake the video. But if I see video of Jeremy doing something, ordinarily I'd have thought, oh, if you bring that up in court, you know, you can imagine Jeremy's defense lawyer. I don't know why I picked Jeremy. Sorry, Jeremy. You can imagine Jeremy's defense lawyer saying, yeah, he could have done that if he had 10 million quid. But if he had 10 million quid, he wouldn't need it to rob the bank in the first place, would he?
I feel like we need a longer segment on this, and we're running out of time on this show.
I'm interested in what the community think about this. How are you going to change how you view video?
Yeah, I would like to hear what the community's got to say about this, and then maybe if there's more of an appetite for us to discuss this, we could actually revisit it, because I think there's a lot buried in this discussion. So go to community.badvoltage.org or go to our brand new Slack channel and come and hang out with us. So you can find out about that
in the outro.
Somewhere on the website. In the outro. Of which is coming right now. We have a show.
We do.
We mentioned, 3 minutes ago, 2 minutes ago, 30 seconds ago, about the Slack channel. Jeremy, do you want to fill everybody in about this Slack channel, how people can get started?
Sure. So we used one of the open source bots to automate you joining, and Stuart will put a link to that in the show notes, so you can just click on that.
I will.
Boom. And come chat with Slack. It's already quite a few people already joined. We got some good conversation going. The presenters are participating in it, for those wondering, because that did come up multiple times. And come chat.
And just to be clear as well, the forum's not going away anywhere. Like, there's still, still a great place for people to have conversations and hang out. But there was some interest in us having a real-time channel. So Slack is there as well. So go and join it if you want to, or just go to the forum, whatever you prefer. So.
Okay. Well, that was cool.
There we go.
Welcome back.
It's good to be back.
Welcome back. But I do want to note to the listeners, if you see a video of Jono running Windows 10, not a deep fake. That is legitimate, authentic video.
I actually want to say a big thank you to a friend of mine at Microsoft who provided a free copy of Windows 10.
Oh, you're joking! You didn't even buy a copy of Windows 10. You're such a scam artist.
Look, it's just an exchange of value, Stuart. That's all it is. It's just an exchange of value.
What value precisely did Microsoft get out of you by not being here on the Microsoft show?
Maybe it's that I'm not using Linux. Maybe that's the reason why. Although then Apple should get some kind of I don't know. I was just calling in favors, so I really have nothing more than that. So
idiot,
but it's going well. And I actually have to say, I had a trip to China a while back, and I set up a burner machine and I put Windows 10 on there, and it's actually not bad. It's better than I was expecting. They've done a reasonable job. I wasn't a big fan of Windows 7, but it's decent. I mean, I wouldn't want to use it as my main productivity machine, but for my purposes, for the studio box, it's fine.
It has improved. And if you have questions, Jono, or people listening, about Microsoft's view on open source and so on and so forth, I think Steve is still happy to answer questions on the thread that got started on the forums. A whole bunch of people asked questions, and Steve Wally very kindly did answer them. But if you still got thoughts on Microsoft and open source, I'm sure he'd be happy to answer your questions.
Now I'm curious to check out Windows 10. I have not used Windows since Chicago, so...
Chicago.
That is the last version of Windows I used on a machine I own.
Yeah. I felt like Windows 7 was this awkward balance of trying to be a tablet and trying to be a desktop. And there's still a bit of that in Windows 10, but it's better than I was expecting. You know, and you know, to be fair to Microsoft, they've got years and years of legacy Windows stuff that they have to think about. It's not as simple as just, you know, releasing a new OS. So I think they've done a decent job. And we've already talked in the show previously how we think Microsoft is, you know, doing more and more interesting stuff. And, you know, so...
Yes.
Yeah, kudos to Microsoft for doing that.
Yes, so come and chip in. Join us on community.badvoltage.org. Join us on badvoltage-slack.horrorcrap.com.
And yes, we will be back in a couple of weeks.